Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
There's no tiptoeing into the unknown. Welcome to the future of medicine, where disease is no match for tenacity. No match for ingenuity. Where together, we go boldly. Learn more at goboldly.com.
Hello, listeners. This is Scott Bland, your host. We have a bonus episode of the Nerdcast for you today. The executive directors of the two House campaign committees, so the NRCC's John Rogers for the Republicans and the DCCC's Dan Cena for the Democrats, are battling for control over the House of Representatives in 2018. They don't agree on much, from who's more unpopular, Nancy Pelosi or Paul Ryan, to just how many seats are at stake in the House of Representatives in 2018. But they both sat down together for a conversation with Playbook co-authors Anna Palmer and Jake Sherman for a live broadcast interview in Washington, D.C. on Thursday, and we are giving it to you to listen to now. Before we get to the interview, a reminder, you can subscribe to Politico Playbook's audio briefings on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. It is a great way to keep up to date on the essential Washington news in just 5 minutes every morning. With that, here on a bonus episode of the Nerdcast is John, Dan, Jake, and Anna.
And now we're going to welcome the two men who are spending millions of dollars and making a lot of consultants very happy. No, I'm kidding. Dan Cena, the executive director of the DCCC, and John Rogers, the executive director of the NRCC.
Thank you. Come on in.
Give them a round of applause.
Thank you.
Hey, man. Thank you. I get up, but I'm afraid that I'd knock this microphone down.
Sneak in.
Okay, so...
Get close to the microphone.
Okay, like yeah, get really close. Closer. Uncomfortably close.
And break out some political water.
Thank you.
Coming soon
we don't have Trump water, but we have Politico water. Okay, so we are less than a year from Election Day. And give us your elevator pitch for why you are going to keep the majority and win the majority.
I think the...
This is John.
Yeah. Hi, John Rogers, everybody. Nice to meet you.
We're really saying it for those in podcast land. But
there we go.
But he did a hand wave, too, so that was really that was a good extra
Enter hand wave. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you could hear the... Anyway. Yeah, I think the short, you know, easy one-word answer to that is Nancy Pelosi. I think that, you know, you've got a proven situation there that didn't exactly work out so well the first lap around. And on top of that... You know, I think, you know, you'll likely hear my counterpart talk about, you know, the seats that they have that they're focused on. But, you know, there are 12 seats out there that Donald Trump won that Democrats currently hold or are open, which are a great opportunity for us to go and take. We've got some great opportunities in, you know, a place that, you know, we haven't necessarily played in before, in like a Pennsylvania 17. We've got a great candidate up there, a guy named John Sherrin, who's already raised a bunch of money in that seat. We've got a lot of opportunity up in Minnesota. Top open seat in Minnesota's first, held by Tim Walz right now, who's not running again. And really like our chances there. We have two really strong candidates. Can go on from there. You know, really like Minnesota 8, Rick Nolan's seat, who, you know, frankly, has really only got elected the last two cycles because he was running against Stuart Mills, is going to be running against a really strong candidate named Pete Stauber and has a primary on his hands, you know, which will be really interesting to see how the primaries play out on their side, because they've got, I think it's only three or four competitive seats where they have one candidate running in those seats, and they've got a whole host of candidates in a lot of the others, which I think is going to drag their team to the left.
So, all right, so
this will be fun.
Sure.
Dan,
yeah, sure. Thanks, John. First of all, thank you very much for having me. Look, John's a very, very smart guy. We realized in the back we were actually neighbors, which was was great. But look, the reality
that could,
is...
That could get really bad.
It was actually kind of a funny revelation. Look, the truth is, with all due respect to my counterpart, the sheer size of the battlefield we have built and that we continue to build. We have 91 targeted races. We have 86 viable races already. Candidates where we have candidates who have raised six figures. The sheer size of the battlefield that we have is substantial in strategically positioning us to be able to take back the House. I think one of the key pieces that's important to realize is that energy is on our side. And in regards to the first comment about the primaries, and I'm sure we're going to get into the primaries a little bit more, but you know, I don't know of a whole lot of races that have been lost as a result of too much energy. I just don't know that. I haven't heard of that. And so the sheer size of the battlefield combined with the grassroots energy that we're seeing on the ground, and then you combine that with what is an incredibly, incredibly unpopular legislative agenda. You know, the Republicans from day one of this sort of new full empower mode, if you would, completely botched healthcare. They completely botched. My colleagues on the Republican side are spending $6 to $8 million a week. Let's just stop there for a minute. $6 to $8 million a week is being spent on their own members, on their own votes, just to make sure they vote for the tax bill. They're having to pay for their own votes on the healthcare on the tax fight right now, and it just goes to show how deeply unpopular the legislative agenda they're working towards is.
So I want to ask you, Dan, though, because I think this primary issue is an issue that is obviously going to be running through the next several months, and I think the point that maybe I don't want to make John's point for him, but that we Jake and I talk a lot about is if you have multiple Democrats running in these seats, that some of these candidates are going to be pulled to the left in order to actually win. Yeah. How do you counter that or make sure that that isn't going to be the big problem?
Well, I think a couple of different things. First of all, I think as we saw in the Republican primaries last year, the primaries play an enormous and important part of the process. And I think it's hard. I don't think anybody can argue with how much Donald Trump really benefited from the primaries last cycle. I spent a little time today just reviewing in preparation to see you all, and it's very nice to see you all. I spent a little bit of time reviewing what happened in Virginia. So let's just look at the most recent big election that we just had, nationalized race. Let's just think about this for a second. So you basically had a contested Democratic primary and a contested Republican primary. You look at where turnout went through the roof on the primary, went through the roof in the primary. Terrific energy, monumental energy. On the Democratic side, you look at where votes came from for the governor's race, turnout stayed high. Turnout stayed high in the dark blue areas. Turnout stayed high in the Democratic areas. On the Republican side, it dipped substantially. Now, on the Republican side, they also had a primary. And let's remember, the primaries do go both ways. And my counterpart, I do not envy the task you have in terms of holding the party together. There are sort of strong forces on multiple fronts.
In both parties, to be fair.
There's a real difference of holding the party together when you're in power. And so I think the key piece to notice here is, even in Virginia itself, significant turnout in the Democratic areas in the general, significant drop-off in the Republican areas. Having voted for an institutional, sort of traditional Republican candidate for governor, I think that tells a huge amount about how the primaries can really benefit the Democrats.
John, you seem like you're itching to respond.
Yeah, for folks listening at home right now, that was me itching for a little while. I'd love to talk about Virginia. Obviously the results of the governor's race, you know, on the top level were what they were, but when you look at that, the areas that Trump won, there was higher turnout, and Gillespie won by a higher margin than what was there in the past. So it's not like things were really just down in Republican areas. They were actually up from where they were. And yes, things were up in the Democratic areas and by more than they were up in the Republican areas. But, you know, a lot has been made over the seats that have been flipped in the state house there. But when you take a step back and look at geographically where they are, the vast, vast, vast majority of them are in currently Democrat-held congressional districts. So you look at that, you have one district that flipped that was in the western part of the state. You had, I believe it was three that were in Virginia Beach, in the Democratic area of Virginia Beach. You have a handful that were in downtown Richmond, and then the rest were basically in Alexandria. And there was, I think it was 12 or so that were, like, if you look at it on a map, it's really clustered in that, you know, that corner of the state. You know, and in that corner of the state, these are a bunch of seats that, you know, Hillary Clinton got 62% of the vote in, and that, you know, that Gillespie was outspent 2-1 in that DMA. So you look at that concentration of where these seats really flipped. There was a massive amount of spending that occurred on the other side in that media market, which is really tough to overcome in seats that, you know, that you know, frankly, were Clinton seats. You know, and this is very similar to what we saw in the Georgia special election, where, you know, we saw that very early on where, you know, and in the state house, a lot of people that I've talked to in that Virginia race, there were a lot of people that seemed to be surprised by that, that like their polling didn't really show what was there. And really early on in that Georgia race, we started to see, you know, that this, like, you know, some of these tectonic shifts that were occurring and allowed us to plan and get ahead of that and win that race.
We'll be right back with more of our Playbook audio briefing. But first, a word from our sponsor, Pharma.
There is no tiptoeing into the unknown. Now is the time to put the accelerator to the floor. The best is yet to come, like advancements in personalized medicine and immunotherapy, and it's coming faster than we can imagine. Welcome to the future of medicine, where disease is no match for tenacity, no match for ingenuity, where together we go boldly. Learn more at goboldly.com.
Let's talk about something that has been an issue in every House race basically in the last almost decade, and it's Nancy Pelosi. And that's, if you, Republicans have pretty much said publicly that she has been a difference in races.
That's all they need.
That's what Republicans say. So I want you to both talk about that. She's obviously, like any congressional leader, a very unpopular, has very low approval ratings across the country. Dan is going to argue that it doesn't matter. John, you're going to argue that it makes all the difference. Let's hear it.
In that special election in Georgia, I think the number was 92%.
And just so we talk about the special election, it was John Ossoff, who was a young Democrat from the Georgia area, and Karen Handel, the Republican, who ended up winning that race.
I think it was 92% of the ads that were running that against Ossoff. We talked about Nancy Pelosi. So, yeah, I think it's a difference maker that's out there. You know,
tell us how unpopular she is. What do your polls show?
I would say wildly unpopular, but I think it's
give us a number. But like
wildly unpopular.
Single digit approval, single digits?
I don't know about single digits. It all varies by district. You know, I think there's real intensity there, and okay. I think that there is a measure that you, like, let's even take it beyond polling. I think there's a measure there that is a bit of an intangible, that if you were to go outside of the Beltway and sit down at a coffee shop and talk to somebody about, you know, what do you think about putting Nancy Pelosi back in charge of government? There is this, like, response that you get is that it is a reflex that seems to be this, like, baked sort of response where people remember what it was like, you know, back then, and that they don't want that again. And I think that what we're going to see is a lot of matchup between, whatever my counterpart here is got going on, and, you know, and Nancy Pelosi on the other side of that.
I wish you guys in podcast land could see the facial impression.
Dan is it?
Yeah, I wasn't looking at him, so who knows what he was? Who knows what he was eyeing me over?
You know, John, it's almost like you forget y'all are in power just for a minute there, and I totally appreciate where you're coming from. The reality of the situation is, and I'm sure this is uncomfortable, is Paul Ryan's actually has lower favorability ratings than Nancy Pelosi does right now. Well, you can read
that's not the only thing they disagree on.
But look, here is the reality of the situation is in every major measurable factor since the beginning of the year, who do you trust? Who's on your side? Where are you on jobs? Where are you on taxes? Where are you on every major issue? The Republicans started the year in a very strong place, as they should. They control everything. And now there are very, very – actually, there are almost no issues where the Democrats don't have a natural advantage. Now, and where the public opinion has moved in that direction. The truth is next year's election is about the president. It's about sitting members of Congress, who are not willing to meet with their own constituents. It is about how what is happening from a values and life
every single day, day-to-day experience that members and people are having with their own members when they're not hosting town hall meetings, when they're not willing to have conversations. We can talk all day about who the potential leader could be. The reality of the situation is the people who have been led and been asked to we have voters in this country who have asked their local leaders to represent them. They can't even get appointments with them and open doors with them. So I just find a very, very hard, I have a very hard time believing, giving all of those natural scenarios, that somehow Pelosi is going to be part of this.
So, well, Dan, let's be frank, though, for a second. I mean, at the end of this cycle, Democrats in the House will have been out of power for 8 years.
Yeah.
What has changed, and what are you doing at the D-Trip different this time than maybe you did last cycle, where you really think...
Or the last four cycles.
That you think is really going to be the change maker, sure. That's going to be the difference.
Well, look, first of all, the sheer size of the battlefield. I cannot emphasize to folks enough how big and how massive the battlefield is that we are working through. We have a battlefield right now. We have 91-plus targeted races. We have 84 of them that
John,
are
you don't
already
think that's the case, do you?
Viable.
No, and neither
already
do the people
viable.
That
hold on a second,
races.
Now, I mean, I also want to go back.
24 toss-up seats right now.
Hold on a sec. My counterpart, again, very smartly pointed out in Virginia that we basically won all the Clinton districts. I'd like to remind everybody that if we win the Clinton districts, we take back the House. And so while the battlefield is big and dynamic, my counterpart next year is going to have to choose between where do you let people go and then where do you go down with them. And you've already pointed to a few incumbents you want to go down with. And so I just think the reality is the battlefield, the fact that they are in power, is a substantially different setup.
I think if he holds on to that, he's going to have to make some tough choices too, because that's just not – right now they're – and this is not me. This is like the ratings agencies have about 24 seats that are rated as toss-up. So the independent, you know, bipartisan situation – disagrees with whatever, sure. You know, battlefield number you put out there. And so, you know, I really hope that you commit to that, because we are also going to be on offense. There are also seats that Trump won that Democrats currently hold that we are going to go and get. And, you know, and that's just not, that's, you know, your side of the story. But, you know, there's another side to that as well, that we're going to be on offense as well. And Nancy Pelosi is wildly unpopular out there.
And I'm having a hard time remembering how many seats started as a toss-up. I think there were three or four that began as a toss-up, and now we're up at 24.
I don't believe that's
Look,
the case.
The reality is in 2010... the only seats the Republicans lost when they took back the majority, there were three dark, dark, dark blue seats that they lost. Like Hawaii, for example. It's fair that you lost the seat in Hawaii. The idea that somehow our incumbents who have survived 2014 in particular are now vulnerable. 2006, do you know how many Democrats lost in 2006? Zero. History's just not on the side. It's not. It is a dated view of the battlefield, and it's just history is just not on their side.
Well, whoever is right, we're going to have this podcast to listen back to.
For posterity.
Given the fact that we're neighbors, he's probably going to we're going to barbecue.
Yeah, he's going to come.
We'll be at a barbecue watching the whole thing. We'll play it back.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you will
over and over again.
Well, I do want to tackle with the tax bill, which has been brought up a little bit here. So, John.
We only have a couple minutes left, so we have to do a rapid fire.
So, we'll do a rapid fire.
Fire. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to talk about the policy, but I do want to talk about the polling, because everything that we've been told from members that have been polling in their districts and other people is that it doesn't poll very well. How do you change that narrative?
And what is the narrative?
Yeah, I have a different opinion than a lot of people on the whole tax reform, on that, because, you know, it's really hard to pull a hypothetical, which. If you just like the, you know, you're basically taxing, you're basically pulling the current messaging that's going on in that day. My own view of that is, you know, you're looking at polling where, you know, I've seen polling that shows that I think it's 36% of people are $400 away from a personal economic collapse. And when tax reform occurs and when their folks' withholdings change in January, February, whenever that is, and they see that they have another $100 in their paycheck, that's going to mean a lot to them. And it's, you know, if your question is, you know, hey, I gave you $100, do you like that or do you not like that? You know what the answer to that question is going to be. So I think it's really hard to pull that and get a fair read on that right now.
Dan, that's a tough thing for you guys to contend with.
Yeah.
People are going to have more money, and it's going to be Donald Trump and the Republican Congress that gave that to them. Right?
Well, I see the point that you're making. I think the biggest challenge we have is when you're spending $6 to $10 million a week just to get your vote, your members to vote for it.
But if they have the money, what does it matter?
Well, look, I think everything. Well, that's a fair point. But I think the reality but the reality is they're doing it to even get to neutral. Look, let's be honest. If this thing does elevate, it's going to get to neutral. And we're living in a world where basically we've asked the Republican members to be able to pass a tax package. Good for you for doing something this year. The reality of the situation is the electorate doesn't trust the current Republican leadership. And the idea that that's somehow going to significantly be your shot to win the House back next year, I'm sorry, to hold the House next year, the gut reaction to this is bad. It's just, again, it's just a dated logic.
Just very, very quickly, we're going to talk about how Congress is handling some of these scandals across the board, which are, luckily for our audience, in both parties. So we could have both people respond to what the political impact of them is. And go ahead, Anna.
What is the impact that the swamp, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, just in terms of these ongoing sexual harassment allegations, the drip, drip, drip of ongoing investigations, how much of a pull is it going to be that maybe just like, let's throw the bums out, everybody?
And both of you guys have been unsuccessful in getting some of these guys out of Congress. So you're kind of both in the same situation here. So let's talk about the impact.
I think it's really simply like the whole thing is just sad and unfortunate. You know, people were hoping for bipartisanship, and like this isn't what they were looking for. You know, it's I really think the whole thing is sad and unfortunate, and you know, and it's on both sides of that.
Yeah, I completely agree. John and I both actually were talking in the back. We both are fathers of daughters, and this is just I don't think this is a political issue in terms of the way we view it. And it's something I think both committees and both sides will take incredibly
seriously. But don't you think there will be an impact in the election, potentially?
Individual elections, you know, overall, remains to be seen.
Could I ask, I'm going to ask one more question. This is something we always like to do with people running races across the country. Give us one either state or race that nobody is watching that could surprise people and go the way that both of you want to.
Go ahead, John.
That's unfair. We should.
I've gotten.
Dan, you go first. Dan, you go first.
You're on the hot seat, Dan.
State or race?
Either.
North Carolina 9, Dan McCready. Watch out.
Which district is 9?
North Carolina 9. He's a Marine.
But who is he running against?
Pittenger.
Okay. John?
Illinois 17, John. Mark Klein. Running against Sherry Bustos.
And
Trump won the district, and I think a lot of folks don't realize that.
And also Minnesota, which you guys both mentioned, is going to be a
hot potato.
And it's been before, and actually the last time it was a very hot potato was 2000.
I think we can both agree that Minnesota's probably the early barometer in the evening for us.
Wow, that's good to know.
I don't know, John, I'm putting words in your mouth.
People couldn't hear me shake my head. Yes.
We
found some agreement at the end.
There we go.
This is good.
We have to wrap it up. John and Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate
thank
it. You. Give them a
really
round of applause.
All right, Nerdcast listeners, thank you for listening. A reminder, you can subscribe to Politico Playbook's audio briefing on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to the Nerdcast, too. We will be back on Friday with our regularly scheduled Nerdcast programming. Talk to you then.